This is The Conversation. It's episode 195 with Jean Shin. She is a Brooklyn-based artist with a very intimidating track record, I will add, among other things to come in a second. Before that, I wanted to point out that we are at 195, close to 200, and just to give you a heads up, I don't think we will have any kind of special celebratory, unusual episode. There have been a couple feelers put out there. Nothing has panned out as yet. I have mentioned in the past once, maybe twice, that a podcast that I listen to regularly that's ahead of us in terms of number of episodes put out, they're in the 300s now, I believe. When that podcast put out episode 200 and 100 for that matter, it was just welcome to episode 100, welcome to episode 200. So I'm going to make a little more hoopla than that, but other podcasts that you may have heard, when they get to their 200th, 300th episode, they do some kind of special episode. So if you guys want to pitch anything that you think would be awesome, feel free to do so, and we'll see what happens over the next. We're looking at probably right around the time gallery season, the fall season starts up in mid-September, somewhere around there. That 200 will come out. So just wanted to put that out there. So back to Jean Shin. She has lived all over Brooklyn, as you will hear. And she is, among other things, one of the chosen few who did public artwork for the Second Avenue subway in New York City. If you don't know anything about it, it was the tunnels were made, I guess, in the 30s, maybe 40s, somewhere around there. And the project went dormant. And then all of a sudden, in to the late 2000s, and then starting in 2010 was when Jean got involved. The project began anew, and now it's done. And so she's got the 63rd Avenue subway with various mosaics and other pieces. And the other artists, just to give you an idea of what kind of names we're talking about, Chuck Close, Sarah Say, and Vic Muniz were the other artists. And unlike them, Jean put together a specific proposal of work for the subway as opposed to just sort of going with their brand, which is what the other artists did. She kind of alluded to that, but I'm going to say it more explicitly. And so anyway, you can see that she's been in the trenches in many ways, not only with this project, but with other institutional installations that she's done all over the place. So you'll hear all about that. I lived, for what it's worth, because we didn't get into this in our conversation, I lived in quite a number of places in Manhattan. I did not live in anywhere in Brooklyn, although I had a couple of studios there. I did live on 2nd Avenue between 5th and 6th Street. So that's technically the East Village many years ago. And yeah, there was no subway. I'm not sure. I guess it passes, stops somewhere around there now. Somebody want to fill me in on that? And I'm sure you in New York obviously don't need to be explained. So it was a three-story apartment building or commercial residential combo. There was a Tibetan restaurant on the ground floor. There were two apartments, one on each side on the second floor, two apartments, one on each side on the top floor, which is where I was, shared with girlfriend at the time. And what else can I tell you about that? I mean, it was a while ago. It was a very different East Village than it is now, I'm sure. It had the infiltration of chains and whatnot was a long ways away. Let's put it that way. So I just want to give you that little tiny piece of my life related to Second Avenue. Let's see, coming up on the back end, I'm not sure yet. It's a surprise. But my name is Michael Shaw, and the website for this podcast is theconversationpod.com. I did not mention that yet. And you can go to The Conversation and you can see a great set of images that Jean has provided, including several shots of the installation at the Second Avenue subway, some with some MTA workers. I'm particularly intrigued by, in addition to her installations, there are shots of her first, what she calls tiny apartment in Brooklyn, which she has graduated to a less than tiny apartment elsewhere in Brooklyn. It looks really quite inviting to me. I mean, I imagine that the picture does not tell the whole story as far as how small it is, but it doesn't look tiny from the shot that I'm seeing. but maybe this is about all there is, in which case that would make sense. There are also a couple of shots of the thing we talk about first, which is the barn upstate in Hurley, New York, that she has been renovating, which was originally going to be just storage, but now she's going to be summering, or I should say spending some time up there over the summer. And so there's a great shot of the landscaping around the barn, and then there's a really great shot of this sort of patio area with bricks and then logs encased behind chicken wire, which is quite impressive. So Gene, all that to say, Gene, if at all possible, could I get you to interior decorate my my house, my apartment? And maybe you could sort of subcontract somebody to organize my studio, which is always in need of order. Just a couple of requests I put out there. As far as requests for you guys, those will come on the back end. You can also support the show, I will just say, by way of introduction, at theconversationpod.com. More on that on the back end. Let's get into that conversation with Gene now. Thank you guys for being here, and look forward to having you around for the 200th episode in the fall. All right. I will talk to you on the back end. Ciao for now. All right. Well, Gene, so you already revealed to me that you're not in Brooklyn where I caught you last time. So where upstate are you?
I'm in a little town called Hurley, New York, and it is steps away from Kingston, New York, which most people know is exit 19 off the highway. It's Hudson Valley.
Right. And isn't Kingston also where one of the sculpture parks is, if I remember right?
Not the sculpture park. You're probably thinking, if you go up the Hudson, there's a few art destinations. This is kind of the stop before you would go off to Woodstock.
Okay.
So that's right. Kind of a destination people would know. And Woodstock is like 20 minutes from me.
Okay.
But Kingston has had its own sort of revival, I think, probably the last couple of years. A lot of people from Brooklyn are literally moving up and starting their own businesses or their own thing.
Right.
So there's a lot of artisanal, startups and wonderful activities going on here.
I think I have heard about some of those artisanal things, actually, in another context of a conversation. But how much of the time do you spend up there? I mean, is this like your summer place or what?
It is my summer place, so you caught me sort of transitioning right before 4th of July.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I will try to spend most of July and August here. I sort of think of it as a summer retreat for myself.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right.
A chance to just get away from the city, focus on the work, let it be a little bit quieter. Although when you're up here, you get different demands, like nature demands a lot.
do you also switch?
It's very unpredictable.
Do you also switch to wearing all white at this point in the summer?
No, wearing all white. I wish I could wear all white, but I'd be covered in dirt from all my landscaping work.
Oh, okay, got it.
Taking care of the garden and just being able to enjoy like physical work at a different level.
Right.
But yeah, it's just very demands of country life,
And when you're not, you're there for essentially the central part of the summer, and during the rest of the year, are you subletting it out or what's going on the rest of the year?
No, it's not. It needs a lot of work. It's a real fixer-upper. It's a farmhouse from the 1850s with a big chicken coop and a four-story barn. Mm-hmm. That's the reason I bought it for art storage back in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
And I really thought it was art storage. Like, I was going to move my art from my Brooklyn storage and call it a day and never see the place unless, the truck needed delivery.
Right.
And then I just, over the months that it took us to relocate my art storage and fix it up a little, I sort of started to fall in love getting away for the weekend. It started to hook me in a way that I hadn't imagined. And now I feel very invested in this sort of double life, Brooklyn urban scene in the regular fall and spring, very, very intense and loving it. And then just kind of getting away. Mm-hmm. So I do get away as often as I can on the weekend.
Right. So you didn't realize then, on some level, how much you needed the escape and the quiet, perhaps.
Yes, I didn't realize that. I just thought the intensity was I needed space in Brooklyn, and it was my storage, and I needed to get address this right away in a long-term way. So I was thinking very practical.
Right.
And I just didn't want to rent another storage unit. It was like getting to the point where I would be asked to do a show, and they would say, well, we want you to do the solo show. This is the main gallery. And, you know, it would be 2,000, 3,000 square feet. And I would start to calculate, like, what that would mean in the storage impact when the work returned to me.
Right.
You know? And I would start to say, do you have a small project space? You know, I don't really need to take up that much space.
Right.
I could take this little tiny space in the corner.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, what am I doing? I'm shortcutting my creative, you know, ambitions for work, you know,
yeah.
Because sheer practical square footage on art storage in Brooklyn, you know.
Yeah.
So I decided to make this big move to figure this out. And what I didn't understand was it wasn't just art storage. I had too much stuff in my life and not enough space. And Brooklyn had changed so radically since I've been there. And it used to be a place where there was space and sort of a sense of freedom and edginess. You know?
Let me jump in. Can we talk about that? So first of all, let's go back to the city, if you will, in spirit. So is it Red Hook that's your Brooklyn neighborhood?
Yes, I live in Red Hook.
Right.
I've moved around quite a bit. I went to Pratt Institute, so I knew sort of Clinton Hill, Fort Greene, even Bed-Stuy in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And then I moved from there to sort of understanding Carroll Gardens, which is close to where I'm living now. And then I shifted in the late 90s to like Williamsburg, you know, and that whole scene, which was wonderful. I just felt like it was the time to be in Williamsburg, you know, before it all kind of dispersed. And Chelsea became its own beast.
Right.
Should I say beast? Should I be more neutral? anyway, Brooklyn had a day, and I was really, really happy to be part of that. But then I took a residency. I was out of the city for 6 months, and I came back when I was living in the Gowanus area, and came back and resettled in Red Hook. That was since 2003.
Mm-hmm. So you've been in all the major artist neighborhoods of Brooklyn at this point, it sounds like, virtually, except for Greenpoint, pretty much.
Yeah, I didn't need to be in Greenpoint. Williamsburg was close enough.
Right.
I was in Dumbo for a number of years before Red Hook, too.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, yes, all the waterfront locations in the New York area.
Would you say that you're somewhat permanently settled in Red Hook now, or is that still another possible?
I am.
Yeah.
I am. Mm-hmm. You know, I had been moving around so much, and when I put, this is going back to the art storage again, when I put my art storage away for 6 months traveling to Asia on a grant and a residency, I'd move my stuff. And then I was like, oh my God, I don't want to keep moving that thing again.
Right.
You know, it's so much. And I was at a sublet of a sublet. I mean, that's how ridiculous it was, you know, and it's going month to month. And then, you know, they could come back anytime in Germany and kick me out.
Right.
You know?
Right.
But they hadn't, you know, and I'd been there a while. So I was just getting tired of all the moving. And so I said, before I move everything out of that art storage, let me just leave it there until I can find something permanent. So, I scraped a budget together and said, what can I get for this? And I found this, you know, 1,000 square foot ground floor space in Red Hook. It was like a little too small for a major contractor or a real business,
mm-hmm.
you know, and not sellable for a lot of means, you know. So it was like an odd space, but it was perfect for me. And it will be somewhat permanent for as long as there's no other hurricanes that wipe me out.
Right. So is it a live-work loft,
then? I mean, as
long
as literally it doesn't sink. Right?
So is it a live-work loft, then?
No, it's a commercial ground floor space, like a store, you know?
Uh-huh.
I don't live there. I live close by, bike, to my apartment, which is only like
Well, that was what I was asking about. So give us the full picture. So you've got the 1,000 square foot studio that you have described already that you've settled into, and I guess you bought, right? So what is the situation with your apartment?
So I have this apartment in sort of Cobble Hill / Columbia Heights. It's along the waterfront, you know, so if you go west of Carroll Gardens or Cobble Hill, it's right there. And it's really great. I have bought that place as well. And I feel like real estate has kept me in Brooklyn, just really knowing early on that I wanted to stay after school. And instead of just renting, I was just, you know, Williamsburg was cheap back then when I was doing my graduate studies, and I was looking at the price and saying, I could afford this. We can rent things out and we could fix this up, you know. Mm-hmm. But I had visions on being in New York permanently. And so we really had our eyes kind of looking at purchasing. Scaled down, we bought the tiniest little apartment, and then I rented studio spaces. We didn't go for the broke, like buy the big thing. We went for buy what we can, keep it modest. You know, we were both working, my husband and I. I married very early, so it was like I had a very stable life. And so I wanted something really modest that we could, you know, just live in. And that little tiny apartment in Cobble Hill was like a gold mine to me. We bought it for nothing, and suddenly we woke up and the recession had passed and the market in New York had hit, and it was going for over $500,000. And I was like, what? Who? What happened? So we just, like, you know, sold that to buy something bigger, which is where we're living.
So just to clarify, so you what I'm hearing is that you bought a small place, you and your husband bought a small place in sort of the Carroll Gardens or adjacent to there, and then you were able to sell that and upgrade to a slightly larger place in a similar area?
Yes. I mean, I would say small is like a generous term. It was the tiniest little
apartment. Oh, okay. Right.
and then leverage that to a much bigger, normal size, very comfortable apartment now. And it's the same thing. We just kept leveraging that to, you know, getting more mortgages and just paying off a little bit and then, you know, pulling money out for another down payment for the studio.
Right.
So we just kept leveraging one into the other. But it was all because of this little tiny apartment that turned into this little gem, you know.
Well, let's talk about that. That's an interesting process or prospect that you are able to leverage. And I'll just set this up by saying, you know, when you look at the market now in expensive neighborhoods, whether they're in New York or California or Los Angeles or wherever, the idea that you would have a place that's worth a lot, right, and that you would then sell because, you know, you can get so much for it, but then say you want to stay in the same or similar neighborhood, how does that make sense? You know what I mean? So I'm sort of getting the sense that just by having sold a place, that gave you some kind of almost like a credit history. It gave you sort of a home ownership history. So when you use the word leverage,
so yeah, that's, I mean, yeah. You know, the little place was very modestly priced. It was cheap. It was back in the day, Carroll Garden was not necessarily a sought after neighborhood. Mm-hmm, this is what I'm talking about. Brooklyn being so back in the day, edgy, like Smith Street was boarded up.
Right, you know? Right.
So it was very Italian and hadn't gone through the major gentrification. Things were affordable.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you see the value that it's accrued, you can put that to a much greater down payment and then go into debt, of course. You
know, I see.
You're getting on a bigger mortgage for a bigger situation. But it keeps you in the market.
Right.
So you're continuing to reinvest. You know, you're just reinvesting in something that could potentially grow even bigger.
Right.
Because this one had maxed out. We were saying there is no way it could go any higher than this. Of course, we were wrong. Our neighbors were like, did you know the next apartment sold for a little bit more than that? You know,
right.
It keeps going up. But at the time, we thought there's just no way. We thought this was it. This
right.
was maxed out. You know?
Right, right. So with the place that you and your husband have now then, are you in a mortgage situation that is relatively comfortable, would you say?
Totally. I mean, we've still kept it modest, you know, because our incomes aren't very high.
Right.
We wouldn't qualify, actually.
Okay.
And then when we refinance, I mean, this is the artist's struggle. I mean, we are comfortable homeowners for decades. And I could, when I remortgaged, refinanced, I couldn't qualify for the mortgage that we have now. And the rates were better. So it was just giving us a discount. You know, and between my teaching job and just my unpredictable art business, I could not qualify. And they told my husband, well, if you just remove Gene from your mortgage, you'd qualify immediately. I mean, that's so depressing, you know. And I said to him, well, I own the place, co-own with you, but you own the whole full debt. I'm okay with that.
Right.
But it makes me, like, what does that say about artists and society that we can't qualify for a mortgage?
So you know, the
even
bank,
a refinance, meaning so, I have the debt, you could do nothing and I would still be your risk.
So the bank then liked your husband on paper much better? Is that what you're saying?
A little bit better. He owns his own architectural firm. So it's still a business as opposed to getting a traditional job.
Right. So they weren't ecstatic over his title, but at least it was better than yours is what you're saying.
Exactly.
Right, right.
The spectrum.
So the other then, you know, sort of all of this, while very important and useful, is the sort of the subtext or the underscore of all of this is the G word, gentrification, right? So, and this is interesting, I think, regarding you, because it sounds like you are sort of straddling this line in a way between artists who is sort of trendsetting, you know, and moving into places that then go up, but you're also participating in the marketplace as well, right? I mean, to what extent, I guess, do you feel like you have been a gentrifier, or what is your relationship to that word?
Right. I mean, I certainly have take some responsibility to that. However, in the spectrum of things, I'm not coming in as on the high end of gentrification. I'm, like I said, I have the tiniest, modest little hole in the wall apartment.
Right.
So I live very modestly and no one paid any attention to me. And that was the same thing with Williamsburg. I mean, I left there when I felt like there was too many piercings and you could freely tell people you were an artist. And that was okay, you know, and that was sought after. You know, we were always under the radar and we wanted to keep it that way. We loved moving into neighborhoods that had character and we wanted to keep it that way, you know. So our artist identities were really kept, you know, kind of off the radar because I didn't want to upset anything, you know. I just wanted a place that was affordable to live and took the risk because it wasn't always the safest neighborhoods. Or the hippest at the time. Mm-hmm. So certainly I participated, but I don't do it. I certainly don't feel like I did it in a blatant way.
Sure.
Where people come in,
right,
you know,
right.
Advertising themselves as gentrifiers and
sure.
taking over things. That was not my
right.
agenda. I just wanted a place to be able to, I knew I wanted to live in New York and
right.
I wanted to figure out how I could do that on, you know, an artist's life, you know?
Right. Well, and apart from the whole question of being a gentrifier, which I think you answered, there is the state of being a resident, as you know, as well, which is entirely different, which is you kind of alluded to it being under, quote unquote, under the radar. But what's more interesting to me is, I mean, even if you're under the radar, you yourself are still experiencing these neighbors who are very not under the radar in many cases, right? I mean, some of these neighbors of yours, I presume, are quite wealthy. So what is it like, you know, being with the yuppies? What is it being like with being in a bougie community?
Oh, you mean now?
Yeah, now.
Yes, now it's a totally different. Yeah, it's true. Well, I certainly have benefited from, I have a child who, you know, the little neighborhood that I ended up planting myself and making home ends up being a really great public school district.
Mm.
And And those who can afford private school still want to, in principle, send their child to their local elementary school. So we ended up sort of landing a wonderful community of people who really invested in the local school, which is in New York really quite special. But yes, I had met through my my child lots of friends who are lawyers and work at, you know, foundations, and but also the creatives, you know, who are writers, editors, photo, photographers and architects and such too. So yeah, I mean, my son often had friends who own brownstones, you know, and he would say, like, what does that mean, Mom? I'm like, how do I explain that to him? that brownstone value is just, you know, millions. I mean, I can't even imagine, you know.
So what do you say to your son?
The disparity is pretty deep.
So what do you say to your son, if anything?
Oh, what do I say? Well, gosh, I try to explain to them just, you know, well, I try to explain money to him, equating, like, let's say, like, if the brownstone is like $6 million, right? And I'll say to him, well, you know, Mom's biggest art commission I got, which was like unheard of for me, but and a huge investment in public dollars is like $1 million for the Second Avenue subway station. And that's like federal, you know, tax dollars going to work, making this big public art project for everyone to enjoy the rest of their life, you know, until the city's there. And yet then this person owns like 1/6 of that budget in the brownstone, you know? So that's been, and they own it, you know, I mean, they have some debt, but they make, they have jobs that can sustain that. And, you know, it's very clear like that I don't, you know, but that we live in a community that has a huge range of people. We live in an apartment. I'm so happy and comfortable in my apartment. And that he's friends with them. And I think that's great too.
Yeah. Well, that's a nice segue that you mentioned the Second Avenue subway, which you are one of the few honored and lauded names that are included in that project. But I do, before maybe asking you about that or you talking about it, I do want to, since you did mention that $1 million figure, clarify if that budget includes materials and the production, you know, what a percentage of that is, you know, income, et cetera, that breakdown.
Oh, yeah. I wish it was $1 million to me.
Sure.
It's not. I mean, it's totally comprehensive. So it includes everything, meaning I had three different fabricators for the four floors that I was working on. And it includes transportation from all of these, you know, the materials, the designing of it. It's extremely comprehensive.
Sure.
And in that scenario, unlike other percent for the Arts Commission, I don't even get 1%. So that gives you the scale.
Oh my goodness. So you're so you're a martyr,
so I'm
making art then.
Making other my fabricators, you know, in the business.
So you're making your fabricators wealthy.
I actually thought when they gave me the budget, I was like, oh my God, I could do so much. But then the minute I called my fabricators and told them what I was interested in doing, I was like, oh wait, you just took half my budget. I still have two more phone calls to make. You know, the fabricators are worth that, but they are very expensive.
To what extent do you shop around, though? I mean, let's say for the most complicated of the three or four different fabrications that you worked on, let's just say, why don't you pick one of those and say, and my question would be, how many people or how many fabricators exist in that category? If you're going to go into the Yellow Pages, right, and look up fabricator for, you know, those glass panels that you did, for example, how many of them would there be? Would there only be one?
Oh, no. I mean, there would, it just depends on how much art experience that they have. There's a lot of commercial glass fabricators and you can choose to work with them. I've mostly chosen art fabricators. So there's a handful and probably like under five who are probably the top. Some of them are all over the world. So So for me, it was really important for them to be close to New York.
Sure.
And, you know, the project was spec to be like Build America. And I really valued that. And I stuck to it as best as I could. Others did not.
Right.
So for me, that was really important that I could visit them and see the work in progress and make many like one-on-one in-person visits to see progress and have meetings, that it didn't mean that I had to travel all over to Europe or go traveling internationally to do this, because that would limit how much access and dialogue I had with my fabricators. And I really wanted to be connected in the process and not so removed.
Where were they, your fabricators?
I should say that the one fabricator, Stephen Mioto, is someone I've worked with on three different projects before that. And I so value working with him. So for me, I did not shop around for a mosaic artist. He was it. And he was my primary fabricator to start with. You know, you build a relationship of trust, and I get to know him, and he gets to know my vision and how I like to translate things.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, each project is different. So this one's unique compared to the one we had done before, but I just know I can talk to him. And if something was off, that I would be open to tell him that, and he would be open to listening and ready to engage again. What can I do different? How would you like it better? Once you have that, and you know, there's no ego in between, no mm-hmm. criticism between the maker, the designer, the vision, all of that. It can be tricky with fabricators because, you know, they're artists in themselves as well. They're really making the work. So there's a lot of sometimes tension if you're not happy with the results. So you need to be able to really communicate with someone.
Right.
And trust them as well, you know?
And where, just overall, were the different fabricators? Were they all in the tri-state area, or were some of them a little further?
Not tri-state. So Stephen's located in Carmel, New York.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, close by, to a couple hours north of the city.
Mm-hmm.
One of my other, the glass fabricator, Tom Patty, his studio is in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. So again, driving distance.
Mm-hmm.
And then Frank Giorgiani is in, what is his town? I've now forgotten. Hope, New York. It's past Windham. So from Hurley, it's about 2 more hours. Less than that. So it's all within, I would say, 5 hours driving distance from New York City.
Got it.
And I love that. They all kind of know each other now. And and I love that too, that they're in dialogue, you know?
So let's talk
celebrating the work.
So let's talk about the process of getting selected for this major public art project, the Second Avenue Subway. Which, by the way, it'd be interesting to know if you happen to need to take it at all. But apart from that, you had yourself and three or four other, you know, super well-known artists. Was this as rigorous and demanding an application competition as one would imagine?
Oh, yeah. The 63rd Street station that I did was the first station that they commissioned.
Mm.
And it was extremely competitive. And I'm sure when they dreamt up like who they wanted ultimately for this line of the Second Avenue, they had put everyone in that boat.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone that they wanted to invite was probably in some level competing. I was one of 4 finalists who actually gave a proposal. It was extremely competitive. And I mean, people who had already kind of made their mark in history. And I actually was really surprised that they chose me, and also really surprised when I was asked, because I actually said, really, the Second Avenue subway station? Is that a joke? I mean, that thing hasn't happened. I mean, for centuries. I mean, it's not happening. This is like a prank call on this.
Right.
I just couldn't believe it. And then when they told me that I was a finalist, I said, who are the others? And I just nearly dropped, like, okay, so now you're setting me up. You know?
Right.
I know you guys like working with me. I did a very successful project out in Flushing, Queens. And I when I finished that project, I said, you know, I really wanted to do a subway. So this is a Long Island Railroad station. So it's a train station. But does that mean that I can't do work with you again because you don't invite artists back? And I said, that's a really different audience than the subway in New York City. And I said, I want to do a project at home, and New York City is it. So they invited me back, but I just didn't really think I would win this competition. So I was really honored and grateful. And the feedback I got was that a lot of people, I mean, the artists I was competing against, as you mentioned, are extremely well-known, really in the art world and yeah. gallery market. Mm-hmm. And they just wanted to do themselves. Like, this is my work, and that's what you're going to get.
Right.
And we'll translate it and put it in the public space.
Right.
But meanwhile, I was actually making a proposal for the site. You know, what does this site mean? What does it mean for the viewer to come and see work? And not just putting a signature work in, although I feel that this work has a lot of themes that run into concerns that run throughout my work.
One of the big reputations around the Second Avenue subway renewal or, you know, final completion was the construction, which obviously affected a number of people on that line. How much were you aware in your piece going up of the, you know, relationship of the construction with the neighborhoods, particularly, I guess, your neighborhood, since it's the Upper East Side?
Right. So in some way, the 63rd Street station had, it had just as much construction. I was going to say that the tunnel was already there because it was earmarked mm-hmm. early century. Mm-hmm. The other ones are tunnels. So our tunnel was there. And in many ways, it's a renovation and not an entirely new station.
Mm-hmm.
But the construction really was massive, the infrastructural work. For me, the project that I proposed kind of deals with that because I was thinking about, oh, my God, are you really serious? The Second Avenue station is going to open. So the fact that the subway line was opening and it was something that had been envisioned 80 plus years ago, I was so struck about the construction that would happen and overwhelm the city. But here's major new infrastructure coming into the city, which really it doesn't happen very often. So my imagery was based on the 2nd and 3rd Avenue elevated trains that had been demolished in the 40s and 50s. And I was thinking about, like, the upheaval and the construction that, half a century ago they were experiencing and how, you know, people today are experiencing the construction of the 2nd Avenue. So in some way it's like history repeating itself. And also thinking about, like, what was lost when we lost the 2nd Avenue elevated train and then what we're gaining by going underground with the 2nd Avenue subway.
But all that said, I'm just wondering if through your communication with the fabricators and the installers, for lack of a better word, if you were sort of secondhand getting word from, you know, the residents about, like, when is this thing going to be over kind of thing?
Oh, all the time. It's just, you just hear so much complaining.
Yeah.
So much complaining.
Yeah.
When people would run into me, and I'd say, oh, I'm working on this major project. And this is I was working on the project from 2010 to 2016. So
wow.
At the end of 16. So it was 7 years in
wow.
making. And people were like, oh, so you're responsible for all the construction
right.
up there.
You know? Yeah.
People would say that all the time. And I said, but once it's there, you'll love it.
Right.
So, yes, it was a lot of construction and a lot of naysayers. But, you know,
yeah.
again, New York so goes into transformation. The minute that work is done and closed up, I mean, people love to celebrate and rise to the occasion. I'm sure the real estate there has boomed since the 2nd Avenue subway station gives them access
right.
to public infrastructure. I mean, it's just like a New York story. You know, you don't think it's possible until it happens. And people like to complain about it and think it'll never happen until it does, you know.
Right, yeah. Well, it sounds like the way I really lit up when you started to finally describe what it was like for you, because that's what I'm interested in, that, you know, you were in a very sort of almost comic sense, you were this, target for that for people's frustration. But by the time they got to you, and you know, you were also the artist, it sounds like maybe with your one sort of lighthearted and your warm retort or response, you know, that just wait, you're gonna love it, you know, that was enough for them to appease them somehow.
Well, for me, I just I just knew that there I had seen the process of making this work and just really believed in all that work when the public saw it, that they would be able to actually celebrate that kind of introduction to the public space in a way that they couldn't imagine. All they're seeing is construction, and it's a pain, you know, and it's very easy target. But it all these great things require some chaos and frustration and investment on everyone's part to just be patient with it. Mm-hmm, and I really believe that if people work together and just saying, hold on, we're almost there,
right.
That they can really then experience why it mattered. And then they can tell the war stories. You know how long I had to live through that construction?
Yeah.
So they can easily be on the other end.
Right. Yeah. I just want to, you know, this is going to be painfully obvious, but I just want to point out that when you leave the site or, you know, wherever you're situated in doing your collaborations over those 6 years, you know, presumably you're going home to a different neighborhood where things aren't in chaos and upheaval. You know, at least that's what they're going to think. So it's easy to say, you know, hey, this is all part of the process. You know, it's going to be worth it when it's done, when you're not sort of in the trenches with them, right?
Totally, totally. But, you know, I would say, like, I'm in my own construction elsewhere, like upstate, you know.
Yeah.
We've been, you know, renovating this old house ever since we got it. So it's in a critical stage right now. We're always living under construction. So I know what that feels like. It's very unsettling.
So are you...
But, you know, I also know I can just imagine it's like so close.
Yeah, yeah.
Imagine how good it's going to be.
So are you and your son and your husband then all up there together upstate?
We are this weekend, yeah.
This weekend, got it. So
yeah, just this weekend.
So you go back down during the week?
I will go back. I have some other appointments and projects in July, and then I hope to get back up here to spend a good month.
Okay.
Mostly, yeah.
Okay. Well, going back to the subway project seems like a good segue to your history with public work and just commissions and that kind of thing. And so basically what I want to get into is your work with the Joan Mitchell Foundation. But on the way there, my sense is that you're constantly working with bureaucracies, you know, applying for public things, applying for commissions, what have you. And I guess based on sort of the way you described the Second Avenue project and the Long Island Railroad project, that you're sort of to some extent in that community, if that's the right way to put it. So just does that make sense? Can you talk about, like, do you feel really embedded in sort of the public art community or landscape or whatever you want to call it, and how much of that sort of application and, you know, and filling things out and bureaucracy and so on would you say is a part of what you spend your time doing?
Right. Well, maybe I'll say that, you know, I have always made these sort of large scale installations and worked with, you know, the beginning places would be alternative spaces that would just give me the floor. And they were labor intensive and they were also in some sense, the scale was very monumental.
Mm-hmm.
And that with that kind of work, I got the attention of like museum scale projects who would commission my work. And I would say my trajectory has always been a relationship between institutions and the same museums. And so I love working with curators, and I love working in the many facets of museum staff and the community, and then the outreach into the public audience. And that's an investment for me. And my work is really grounded there. Surprisingly, when I was in that place, I had been asked to do like a federal government public permanent commission, and all of these previous ones have been temporary. And again, I was just so shocked. I said, I use like discarded ephemera. Like, how could that be permanent?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Honestly, you must have the wrong artist, you know? Mm-hmm. So I entered this after having developed sort of this kind of work of large scale public interventions, you know, at institutions and really working very collaboratively. Working permanently means that I really have to shift in, you know, working with fabricators and thinking about conservation and thinking about, like, you know, the maintenance of the work. And, you know, so it really has grown and developed in my learning curve, mm-hmm. Which I've loved. And in some way, I love, like, you invest a little bit. And I say a little bit. It could be 1 or 2 years. In the worst-case scenario, like, the Second Avenue was, like, 7 years, you know. But then it's there permanently, you know. So the rewards of that that work and commitment is much longer than kind of like you work on an ephemeral installation or an exhibition or show, and, you know, you'll be working like, you know, 8 months to a year and a half, and then it's only up for 3 months, you know.
Right.
So I've really enjoyed the balance. Most of my, you know, like, the kinds of things I do every day still are working with institutions, and probably a good percent has shifted to the public works that are permanent. But it's not that I'm doing many, it's just that they take longer, to realize. I sort of lost your question. The investment. Oh, the investment. I do think public art has a very, very different community. There's some artists like myself who have crossed over and navigate both. It's just that I feel like the art world doesn't have as much respect for people who do spend the majority of their time doing public art. I'm not sure I'm really that artist. I really navigate both. I just finished a project that was like a couple months at Pioneer Works. And, you know, it's very much a, you know, cutting edge institution, very, you know, baby institution for New York City, one I love and love investing. It feels like the early days of my work when I was working with alternative spaces like Exit Art and Artist Space, you know, all those art in general, you know, all those places I love when they're doing experimental works and showing what they think is new, you know.
Yeah.
And now that I've done other institutions like MoMA and Smithsonian, it was a mammoth, you know, just moving so slowly. But capturing a huge audience, it makes sense in my evolution to also want to do the permanent works.
Right, right.
But I do find it's an underappreciated genre.
Well, yeah, let's talk about that. I mean, you mentioned that even though you didn't necessarily categorize yourself as a public artist or an artist making a majority public art, as you describe, you don't, but that type of artist gets overlooked in the art world. Is that, or maybe sort of not as highly regarded. Why do you think that is, and what makes you say that?
I have to probably blame the art market and the gallery scene.
Sure, sure.
I just don't think they're supporting a kind of a diverse range of artists and the kind of works they want to make, you know. And so a lot of public artists go into that arena because they're not being supported and being paid attention to by the galleries, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they're extremely talented, amazing vision and generosity. And so they're making more ambitious projects by being supported by these other public institutions, which I think is amazing and wonderful and should be celebrated. I wish more galleries could also do that, but they don't, you know?
Right. Yeah. And
they don't help production. Right.
Right.
When was the last time a normal size gallery helps production on work? or really supports the artist's vision. It just doesn't happen. And invest that up front, not after the sale, not sharing after the artist has invested everything that they've got.
Well, a normal, quote-unquote, normal-sized gallery is a very nebulous term because, you know, you could take that in either direction. But if we're talking about a normal-sized gallery in the sense that it's not a behemoth gallery, that they, I mean, my answer would simply be they wouldn't be able to afford to do that kind of thing. You know, they would be too risky.
It is true. And I feel like they're as vulnerable as most artists are.
Exactly.
Mid-range galleries,
exactly.
Too, you know?
Yeah.
And we're just hearing so many of our amazing colleagues who've been out there and been doing incredible work suddenly to realize that they can't afford rent and they're closing shop.
Right.
You know?
And exactly.
It's devastating to hear that because,
yeah,
this middle gallery scene is a vital one, you know, for many artists and their support.
Yeah. The other thing that I perked my interest is when you describe your collaboration and your appreciation of that, like with the curators and the institutions. I wonder, and it occurred to me when you were describing, you know, the market, this is obviously is kind of a huge generalization, but you could sort of pick out of that those two different categories that artists working in the market, maybe at least some of them, like to do things their way and are not particularly fond of collaborating, whereas what you do, you know, whether with your smaller alternative spaces or in big public art projects, is very collaborative, and it obviously is something that you are good at and enjoy doing.
Absolutely. I mean, I really love the collaboration because, you know, once you get into art making, and I, you know, I probably began as a very, you know, my work is very labor intensive and obsessive.
Mm-hmm.
And I probably love a lot of control. But at some point I realized there's no way I can do this by myself and finish this work, the amount of time that it will take.
Right.
It's not possible.
Right.
And so by bringing in other people, and it might have been an intern, the first assistant, and I was so worried that this would not work. But then it actually was the opposite. It was truly a gift, this person coming into my studio. Not only was it productive, I actually enjoyed the process, sharing my work with someone and it being kind of a learning process for both of us. Like, how do I tell or explain or to trust, you know, another person to make my work? And when that happened, it was like it just was a well of generosity and exchange.
Yeah.
And so now I really trust that process. It's more going outside that to really partner with museums and, you know, and their community engagement and letting, you know, museum audiences also invite them to the creative process. And, you know, and then I sort of trust that it's okay, you know, maybe we won't hit the kind of quality of standard, but is that more important than someone engaging in the creative process and contributing to the making of an art piece? And for me, the answer is always on the other side. Like, you know, they'll come back and see their work and the work we made together with such pride and like I said, celebration. And they won't even notice if I had, you know, spent all that extra years, months trimming something or making a detail correct. I mean, that's a level of appreciation that only I will like miss or love, and I'll do if I can. But the other part is something I can never do by myself. Even if I wished for it, like even if I wish someone would love my work, they wouldn't, you know, they would have their own issues, you know, but here they come so willing to really enjoy the work and appreciate the work from its inside out.
It sounds like you've been referring to one collaborator, like one assistant for many of the more projects than not. Is that literally the case, that it's been mainly one assistant?
No, actually, you know, there's so many people, dozens of them have come in and out of my studio.
No, I'm sorry. Let me clarify. I'm not talking about one throughout your history of making work. I'm just talking about when you're collaborating on a particular installation, that you have one person as opposed to several people helping out in one given situation.
I always like to have a project point person. Is that what you mean?
No, I mean, let's say your most recent installation. We're not talking about a big public art project. What's your average number of people that are helping you out? And basically, what I'm getting at is, what is your, you know, other than just talking about, you know, how great it is for everybody, what is the dynamic that you set up, and, you know, what kind of boss are you, and, you know, and what is, I mean, are we all just having fun together? You know, are you getting people who are really young?
Oh.
So they're really, they yeah. really appreciate the opportunity, or what? Yeah.
Yeah. I think the youth part of it and appreciating opportunity is a big part of it. So the recent project I did at Pioneer Works, we were given thousands and thousands of slides from the Metropolitan Museum. I didn't have a huge budget, although it had some support. So I worked with someone who was fairly young, who had recently graduated from RISD. She was looking for full-time work. So I really sort of entrusted her. I said, do you want to take this on? It's going to be pretty independent, you know, walk you through what we need to do. And then here's the keys to the studio. You know, come in, do things we need to get done. This is our deadline, you know. And then I gave her support by offering other interns who wanted to join the studio and said, this is the work. Check in with me, check in with Elise. They would go to the studio when they were available. And then I would come in and join them. I would oversee it. And I would always be working on the next step of production.
Mm.
So I'd get to the next experimentation or the next thing we needed to think about. But they were in heavy production. And they owned that. I really think they took pride in that. And then they, at the end, in 3 months short, they helped me install. And we were just like building it together. And they know I could not have done it. No singular person could have done it without all of us contributing their part. So I give them a lot of independence.
Yeah,
so
that's great.
I think you can ask them, but I'm probably really exacting of how I want things done. And it just requires so much labor that efficiency and productivity is key, you know. But I'm pretty chill. I have really high expectations on what I want the work to be like. And I feel like I'm the first to invest in that. And, you know, I sort of lead by example. Like, they see me doing as much and wanting that precision. It's not just barking orders and leaving. So I'm managing a lot of other things at the same time. So.
And the giving this keys to the studio, I mean, that seems like a pretty decent, you know, amount of trust. Is that something that you... something that you have to go through each time you have a new hire, or is it something that maybe you know was more intense when you first did it and now it's not a big deal? What's that been like?
It's probably not a big deal. I mean, I feel like people come to me at a certain time. I do feel it's sort of people find each other. This assistant found me through another great friend of mine, and you know, who was also teaching and said, she is so great. And I said, say no more. When is she coming?
Right.
You know, like, I do trust my friends to trust other people.
Right.
So
right.
It was a very easy interview. I knew she was going to get hired that day.
Right. Okay.
And also then I couldn't pay her enough. I felt because of the budget that I was working with. But I also felt like it would be an interesting project for both of us to work on. So I gave her part of my studio to be in as an exchange. So, you know, it's the old fashioned bartering process. Like, I can't afford this, but I'm sure I have like other benefits. You know, so name my benefits and what can I offer you?
Right.
Same thing with her. Like, she could take any job, but, you know, I trust because she came recommended that she would be the right person, you know? So there's a lot of like, you know, the fringe benefits that come with something. But I do feel like it's important to cover the basics, you know, of that kind of the contract to engage someone so that no one feels abused. But in fact, I feel like they would take that as kind of an independent working relationship with someone, which is really healthy. They have room to grow. They have room to kind of dig into it and push back if they need to. But also a sense of freedom, you know,
sure.
Giving them my studio, essentially.
That's a smart barter. That's smart. So I'm going to transition now to the Joan Mitchell board that you're on. How did you first get on that?
So another artist who's on the board had asked me when I ran into her on some sort of like public engagement, So she just said, are you interested in joining me on the Joan Mitchell Foundation board? And I said, really? I mean, I was really floored. I just couldn't believe that. And I'd served on boards previously for nonprofits.
Mm-hmm.
And I know how much work it is.
Mm-hmm.
And the parts that, you know, I served, you know, the terms for many of them. But the parts that came to a stop was when I had a fundraise. And I'm like, I'm not the fundraiser. That's where it stops. You know,
mm-hmm.
I can, of course, donate my artwork, but really getting others to pitch in and contribute the dollars to fund the kind of programming ideas that we had in mind as a board. That's the tough work of these nonprofits. So then, you know, it's such a different place when you work at a foundation because you're actually generating the funds to give out. And I have really, really enjoyed that role and understand that responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
So I've served from the beginning of this year. So it's been a new relationship, you know, only 7 months in.
Oh, okay. And this, as well as the other board situations that you've been part of, I presume are all volunteer, right?
So on the Joan Mitchell, I do get a small stipend for participating, again, because they have funds and they know that they want work out of you.
Right, right. Does it feel like though the stipend is symbolic as much as anything because the time that you put in it doesn't really feel, you know, appropriate, or how do you see that dynamic?
No, I sort of see it like a teaching gig. You know, I have these adjunct positions that pay something. It softens the blow month to month, you know.
Right.
But it's not that I depend on it and I can't live off it. So it feels like another little stipend that I can depend on throughout the year, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it certainly does help. And I would not say that it's not, I mean, for me, I just live very, very modestly. So any funds that comes in regularly is a good paycheck for me.
Right.
Right. Yeah. So I don't think it's so inadequate. I think they do a good job to keep us engaged, but mostly I'm really engaged with the dialogue that I'm having with my colleagues and trying to make a better place for the Joan Mitchell legacy and how we can contribute to artist support. You know, I think to me that's like, wow, someone pay me to give time to that idea. That's amazing, you know, because I'd be trying to struggle like, oh, if only I had more, like, you know, just when I was doing that project, it's like I'm trying to also support my project, but I'm also trying to support this young artist who's coming of age, you know, and starting to work out. And I want to give her the best opportunities.
But
I only have so much time and resources to do that.
Sure. The thing, though, that I'm thinking about, and I kind of want to imagine that listeners are as well, is as far as grants from the foundation that artists are applying for, that, you know, maybe you can disillusion or just demystify the process of sitting there with your fellow board members and looking at, you know, PowerPoints or whatever it is that you look at together and, you know, and sort of going through the process of deciding on what the range of quality is and so on. Yeah.
So I should clarify, as a board member, we don't do the selection. And our the Joan Mitchell in particular is the nomination only process.
Mm.
So again, we invite other professionals to give recommendations, and that's how we get a nomination pool. So although I have served on different foundations and exhibition programs and so on to be on the selection panel, so I've served as an artist, and I love that. Actually, that's one of the things I love more than anything else is being on that selection panel. But in the Joan Mitchell, I don't do that at all. We're overseeing kind of the larger mission and allowing and facilitating our director and our staff to be able to do that. And then our staff would invite who they feel that year are our selectors, and that rotates all the time. And we leave it up to professionals to make that decision and really work through what are the criteria today that would represent and someone should get a $25,000 grant. You know, like that is up to them. And we really, I mean, it's that same thing again, trust. that they have our best interest in mind, and that we trust the process that we set up to arrive there, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we pay them, so there's no one else has to bribe them.
Right, right. So you are...
I don't look at any portfolios at all. Mm. If anything, we will look and oversee if we're curious, and really we do have due diligence to make sure the process is working well. I have in previous been a juror, so I know that process. As a board, I'm welcome to sit in on the juring process. So, you know, that can inform how decisions are made in the future. So it's really an oversight and to make sure that the responsibility is taken and executed well. You know?
Right. And when, you know, this cliche that gets bandied about quite regularly, you know, the art world is so small, yada, 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 you know. I just wonder if being part of the board, on the board community, if you will, is something that feels like you're sort of constantly running, collaborating with the same people, you know, if from one to the next, there's a lot of crossover and what have you. Yeah.
Well, I feel very lucky that the Joan Mitchell Foundation, and maybe another foundation wouldn't have asked me, but the Joan Mitchell Foundation really puts their heart out and money to address equity. So we hope that we are tapping into artists who are just not that inner circle, and certainly the board is not, does not reflect that as well. So in some way, it's thinking about the broadest sense when it comes to diversity, and that's racial, gender equity, of people who are not well represented already, also geography, like trying to really hit the 50 states and not just the three cities.
Right.
You know, so we're really trying to get our nominators really on a broader sense. Like in states that have never been nominated, we're trying so hard to bring them into the pool and hopefully to have like-minded jurors who recognize that, like, this is an opportunity to really affect change for this artist. And if you've never heard of them, even better, right? Do you like their work? And pick it based on quality, you know, and not because you recognize the work and you just saw it at the major museum or the last gallery show that around the corner, you know?
Right.
So we're really hoping to try to address that inequity from all levels. But it is a award of excellence, you know, that's why you don't just apply. You apply because others recognize it in you. But if you, you know, we're trying to make the nominators as wide-ranging as possible, and for them to think outside the box as well, to think about risk-takers and people who are really championing things and experimental. And, I mean, these are the kinds of things that we feel Joan represented at her time. She is really rare to have survived the period of art that we know she came out of, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and I was going to ask you, actually, as you were saying that, I was wondering to what extent her will described the foundation, or if that was more set up after her passing.
Yeah, that's really our responsibility, is to follow her will. I just joined, so I'm a new member, and in some way I don't own the previous history, so we're celebrating the 25th anniversary next year. So the foundation's been around, but it took a long time. The first, you know, a decade or so was just getting their estate affairs in order. And that takes a long time, the transferring of the works and the inventory and just figuring out what's happening. So, you know, I feel like we're in a different place than we were in the first 25 years. So I'm excited to join the board and shape it in the next 25 versus probably where they were, which is just trying to figure all that out. Like, what was intended by Joan's will? What do we have? What can we do with it? So that's a lot. It's a lot of growing pains to arrive at where we are, which I think is a really good place. You know, our endowment is growing. You know, we have funds. But we're also meeting the most challenging times with arts funding. So maybe our strategies of just, you know, awarding the best isn't really going to cut it and support the kind of work for artists that we need to do. So thinking to be flexible as well and responsive to what's actually happening, which is a major cut in the arts funding, you know, like what's happening with the NEA, what's happening with artists and their communities, what's happening with real estate and affordability, that G word again, you know, like what's happening with our environment. and artists are so in communities that are extremely vulnerable and live in communities that are extremely vulnerable. We have our site also in New Orleans, and I think that we have the Joan Mitchell Center is in New Orleans, and it came out of Katrina.
Wow.
So you can see how nature and art, they're not excused from, you know, the kind of work we do.
Right. Yeah, and as you're describing nature, I'm just thinking back to your sort of comment, very slyly mentioned in passing, about the sustainability of your situation, your studio, I guess, there, you know, that...
Presume, my ground floor studio?
Exactly.
Yeah, it's going to be like Venice.
Yeah, right. Right, so you're making the most out of it until it turns into Venice.
Until it happens.
Yeah.
It's going to happen if we don't stop it, you know?
Right, yeah.
If we don't change.
Well, that's a whole other conversation for a very different time and different show. Well, I hope that you rehab your, or, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? That your refab, I should say, of your barn comes along nicely the rest of the summer. And,
thank you so much,
yeah,
Michael.
It's been great talking to you, Jean. Thanks so much.
Wonderful talking with you.
And we're out. Okay, great. Thanks so much again to Jean. I'm awaiting my invite to the Hurley Barn property as it gets near habitability, Jean. I'm like maybe one quarter, maybe one eighth kidding, or I should say one eighth serious. So don't take that with a grain of salt. Thank you guys very much for being here. Wanted to remind you before I get to some sort of extemporaneous announcement that this is a listener supported show, and your support financially, particularly, really, really helps keep the show going. I did get a lovely pledge from somebody on Patreon for $3 a month the other week, and it had been a long time before that. So I really highly encourage you to support the show financially. If you listen regularly, you can do it again for as little as a dollar a month, which means $12 a year. And if enough people do that, it really does add up for our pocketbooks and our production and our time and Kate Mitchell's tremendous help screening people for the show and producing and otherwise helping, and my time, obviously, and so on. So it really means a lot. You can also donate to the show through PayPal, one-time donation. If you donate $3 per month pledge or $25 or more one time on PayPal, I will send you some bonus episodes, and you'll get bonus episodes infinitum going forward. So you can also support the show non-financially by leaving a nice review on iTunes, helps more people find the show, and of course social media at Artist Podcast. And you can recommend me to other podcasts. Nothing has materialized with my going on another podcast yet, so keep those recommendations coming. The reason is, if I go on somebody else's show, a new audience base will find this show, and they will come flocking over, presumably, as they are wont to do. Okay, what was it that I wanted to talk about extemporaneously? Oh, so we did sort of towards the latter part of our conversation, Gene and I talk about the sort of, we referenced the mid-tier galleries in terms of taking chances and survivability. That seems to be very much a theme in the past and going forward, because I just recorded a new episode with Deb Cloudman and a guest to be named later, and that was a big theme running through our episode. I also scheduled in the calendar a gallerist who closed shop recently, and I'm anticipating that he is going to be no holds barred when it comes to talking about his experience with the art world and from that perspective. So wanted to give you a kind of a macroscopic view of the show, the landscape of galleries, the art world, and so on, and how we're talking about it here. Yeah, I think that's pretty much it. One other thing that I did want to bring up is Also wanted to give a big shout out to Tim Schneider from episode 193. His book is now out. We alluded to it when Deb, Tim Schneider, and I were talking for his episode. It's called The Great Reframing, How Technology Will and Won't Change the Gallery System Forever. A number of people, I think, are already reading it. Kate highly recommends it. And you guys should go check it out. That episode as well has been very popular. So I imagine with interest in the subject matter we talked about, there will be interest in that book. I definitely also highly recommend episode 194, the last one, with another Brooklyn-based artist, Grayson Earl, who is doing and has been doing some very interesting things. And it was really fun to talk to him. So check out those as well. And I thank you guys so much for being here. I appreciate your donations and any other support in advance. And I look forward to talking to you in a couple of weeks. Thanks again. Ciao for now.